The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart.
The Prime Minister.
And our mission is to deliver Brexit on the 31st of October. For the purpose of uniting and re-energising our great United Kingdom and making this country the greatest place on earth.
Well, Boris Johnson finally has the keys to number 10. Brexiters were jubilant that their man had won the day. Donald Trump praised Johnson as a Britain Trump, whatever that is, who would do a great job. But he faces the most daunting challenge on becoming Prime Minister since Winston Churchill in 1940, leaving the European Union. He made his intentions clear last night by sacking 18 moderate members of Theresa May's cabinet and replacing them with Vote Leave veterans. But will he go down in history as the Prime Minister who delivered Brexit or the shortest-lived tenant of No. 10 Downing Street ever? Also this week, can the new Lib Dem leader Joe Swinson attract voters turned off by the two main parties? That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, the love bombing starts here, Johnson told Tory MPs at the backbench 1922 committee on Tuesday night. But there was little love lost when he carried out a ruthless reshuffle the next day. With a government now packed full of committed no dealers, he's made his intentions clear, but that doesn't make the task ahead any easier. Leaving the EU without a deal on October 31st could damage the UK economy, break up Britain, and jeopardise the Good Friday Agreement. But staying in the EU after the 31st risks the end of the Conservative Party and Boris Johnson's premiership. Well, I'm joined to discuss all that by Raphael Baer and Ellie May O'Hagan from The Guardian and Ryan Shorthouse from the think tank Bright Blue. Ryan, this is, in a way, the government that Vote Leave campaigners might have liked to see in 2016, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, it's a kind of Vote Leave reunion. And it was a very radical reshuffle, even more brutal than Theresa May's, when, if you remember, Osborne and Morgan and all of the sort of Cameronites went to the backbenchers. So, you know, you've got a lot of people now who are very sceptical of Johnson, very sceptical of no deal, who are now on the backbenchers, who are a real force. And if you noticed a lot of them tweeting yesterday, they said, look forward to being more vocal about the issues that I and my constituents care about. So you're going to have a very vocal backbench. But I think there are some positives from the reshuffle, which I think the left may like. The first is around women and BME candidates. They are now in record numbers in the cabinet, so there's been progress there. And then secondly, actually, despite all the sort of talk of a hard right takeover, and yes, it is very hard line on Brexit, on fiscal policy, with Sajid as Chancellor, you've got a move away from the kind of sceptical spreadsheet fill approach, and the spending taps are going to come on a bit. So actually, fiscally, at least, you're going to see a drift leftwards from this government.
And Raf, it's a bunch of seasoned campaigners too, right? You see that in cabinet. You also see it in the appointment of Dominic Cummings, you know, sort of senior Vote Leave mastermind of the Vote Leave campaign into Downing Street. Is this a cabinet that's getting ready for an election?
It certainly feels to me like a campaign organisation and a very presidential campaign organisation. I mean, one of the interesting small things that appears to have happened, which is interesting, is that all the special advisers, all the ministerial special advisers, will be reporting directly to Dominic Cummings in number 10, which is sort of slightly tunnelling underneath cabinet government and setting up essentially a kind of a West Wing in Downing Street. And look, the thing is, what do we know about Boris Johnson? He's not good on detail organising things. It's essentially a performance candidate. Everything about this, yeah, the cabinet now, you know, if it has all sorts of contradictions in terms of, you know, still with regard to some of the Brexit stuff, you know, on the detail of whether people actually think you could do no deal or whether that you just need to really bluff more credibly on no deal. So when you actually try and, as it were, sort of turn it into actual governance and administration, it's going to be really hard. But what definitely unites them is this belief, the idea of Boris, the sort of the triumph of the Boris will as the thing that will just get everyone through. Now, that's a campaign proposition. So, that, you know, whether or not that actually turns into an electoral event, I think the style of government we're going to get now is going to be massively campaigny. And certainly, I think plan A is to magic up some new deal from somewhere. And if that doesn't work, very quickly to go to the country and say, look, I can't work with this awful Remainer parliament. I've got this dreadful communist leader of the opposition. come on, people, just let's get this done properly. I'm going to need a mandate, and you go to the country. So I think that there's certainly the likelihood of an autumn general election has gone up.
Ellie, does that feel right? And do you think Labour are ready for that?
Absolutely, it feels right. You know, they think they've already started putting targeted ads on Facebook. I think they're testing out which ones work for their base and which ones don't. And the ones that work, they'll go with. And the ones that don't, they'll jettison. No, Labour is not ready, is the honest answer. I am the token Corbynista of this panel. I would love to sit here and say Labour is ready. I don't think it is. And I think the reason that it's not ready is because I think Labour has made a mistake of assuming that the Remain movement, if you like, is dominated by people like Alistair Campbell and Peter Mandelson, which it is at the top. But the Remain grassroots are also people, particularly young people, who are frightened and horrified by what they see as a reactionary right-wing turn in this country, particularly in terms of Boris Johnson himself. They see him as our Trump. And
Trump sees him as our Trump, to be fair.
Yes. And I think Labour, because it's not really understood or engaged with the Remain movement in a timely way or at all, you might even say, I think that they haven't been speaking to those people who are part of their coalition and who are part of their base. I think if they start doing it now, I think they can turn the tide, but I think they need to do it quickly, basically.
Mm-hmm. I think could I just add something to that? I think there is a presumption in the leader's office at the sort of strategic level that a lot of those people will basically just have to come home, in inverted commas, to Labour anyway, and that a lot of Remain and progressive minded voters more broadly, when they see the sort of the true nature of an awful Johnson administration, that there's a kind of like an elastic snapback, and you will go back to what happened. You can reassemble a coalition of 2017, and a lot of these people just have to vote Labour, and the sort of Lib Dems will sort of deflate. Now, I'm not ruling that out. I think that might actually be a correct judgment. But whether it will happen on the scale that you would need to counteract the equivalent effect happening on the right, which is Brexit Party basically folding into the Conservative vote, I'm not sure. So that might be quite a dangerous strategic miscalculation by the Labour side.
I actually disagree with that. I've been speaking to sources in the leadership about this, and I really don't think that they just complacently assume these people will come home to Labour. I think actually they recognise that the kind of only Labour can beat Boris messaging is kind of a dead end. And I do think that. I think actually, you know, I went to an event in Parliament yesterday where Ian Lavery spoke, and he talked about his constituents.
The chair of the Labour Party.
Yeah, and he talked about his constituents stopping him in the street and saying, I want no deal. Why hasn't it happened yet? And I think for the Labour Party, maybe accepting that its voting coalition has fundamentally changed is sort of a scary prospect. And it's just taking them too long to do it. I don't think it's complacency over its voters. I just think that they haven't yet come to terms with the fact that maybe their voter coalition has changed and they have to adapt to that.
And Ryan, Johnson tried to do quite a bit, didn't he, in his little speech in front of Downing Street yesterday. There was a lot of kind of trust me, we need to be optimistic, we need to defy the gloomsters. There was also a bit of policy, wasn't there? Because he's quite keen to have something to say, isn't he, to the people who aren't just motivated by Brexit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he wants to focus a little bit on domestic policy, particularly around increasing school funding. So per pupil funding goes up, increasing the number of police officers on the street as a response to the rising violent crime rates, and also kind of fix the social care crisis. But of course, Brexit needs to be resolved first. And it does look likely that the final showdown between Leave and Remain is coming in the form of an autumn election. This Parliament has tried for several years now to get Brexit through. It is incapable of doing that. Every option that has been tried has not been able to secure a majority. And in my mind, I think either you need to go back to the people to get a mandate for that, either through an election or a referendum. I think a referendum sort of suits Remainers more because, you know, you're just voting either for Leave or Remain. Whereas if it's an election, the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn in effect become representatives of no Brexit, and, you know, Boris and the Conservative Party become representatives of final minute deal or no deal. And a lot of voters for Remain will find it difficult to vote for Jeremy Corbyn, whereas in a referendum, you know, you're not just voting for Corbyn and Labour, you're just voting for Remain. So I think for Leavers, they feel that they're more likely to get that kind of mandate from the public by going to an election. And I think an early autumn election is made more likely on two fronts now. First is the appointment of Dominic Cummings, who in effect is a campaigner, a clever strategist, and I think that's putting the Tory party on a war footing. And the second, a lot of pollsters will say that when you get a new leader, you get a bit of a bounce. And actually, maybe there's a little honeymoon period that Boris needs to go to. But I think it's inevitable that we've got to have a kind of fresh public mandate. You know, if Boris tries to hold on and then, you know, fails in his kind of last minute negotiations with the EU and is faced with a no deal, there will be a vote of no confidence. He hasn't got the numbers at the moment. So why not get on the front foot and call one in early September so the public give him the mandate for a final last minute thing with the EU before Halloween? If not, he's got the numbers for no deal.
Raf, we should entertain the idea, shouldn't we, that Johnson, or shouldn't we, that Johnson could go to the EU27, he could go to Brussels, he could have a shuttle diplomacy over the summer, and there could be something he can come back with?
I think the problem is that he has said very clearly, and he said it on the steps of Downing Street yesterday, just definitely no to the backstop. And the reason he said that, I think, well, there are a number of reasons, but the crucial one is half of the sort of Johnson team and the people around him seem to genuinely believe there is this thing that you can get, which is the sort of what they call the sort of standstill transition, interim free trade agreement, and that you can go to the EU and say, look, we're not going to have a proper deal in time, but we're going to have, so how about we just all agree to pretend like nothing's changed, but we're definitely not in the EU anymore. And we'll call that free trade agreement because it essentially looks exactly like EU membership. And then we'll sort of dot the I's and cross the T's later. And there's just absolutely no way they're going to get that for a number of reasons. But it's just, you know, one way of seeing it is, you know, if you basically go and try and rent a car and say, look, I'll tell you what, here's 100 quid up front. Give me the keys. I'll bring it back when I'm ready. I promise not to crash it. They will say, you know, Hertz or Avis will say, you have to sign a contract. And then if you do smash it up, there are consequences. And if you say, yeah, but it's me, look at me, I'm a very safe driver, great record, promise no points on my license, what's the issue here? They'll just say no. And there is this failure to understand among a certain segment of hard Brexiteers that the European Union is a legal construct. And just saying, but it's us, it's Britain, come off it, you know, does not get you, you know, total legal parity with the customs union and the single market, unless there is some explanation for what happens if you diverge, if you break the rules. And that's European Court of Justice, that's the backstop for Northern Ireland, all of that. So
all of those things they
all
hate.
Of those things that they hate. So at some point, if Johnson seriously believes that the deal you can get is that one, this, you know, this thing that's being talked about on the right, then it's no deal or an election. If, on the other hand, he is what he and crucially Sajid Javid, I think, is crucial in this, if they actually understand the legal reasons why that's not an actual thing, and they are going to steer more towards what's being called the, you know, the lipstick on a pig scenario, where you essentially rewrite the withdrawal agreement and find some way with sort of Boris chutzpah to say, no, this is actually a different deal and it's not the backstop, it's the Boris stop, then... And then you use the fact that you've made a lot of hard Brexiteers very comfortable in ministerial offices in the back of the limousine, quite enjoying all the baubles of office. You've kicked to the back benches a load of people who will frankly vote for anything. You know, I mean, the moderate Tories and soft Brexiteers are the wettest people in politics. They're always loyal to leaders anyway. They're such cowards. They're not really... Are they really going to do something? Are they really going to force a general election?
You're not convinced by this rebel alliance?
You know, not much. You know, just by the example of the way they've behaved over the last 10 years with when the hard right has captured the Conservative Party. So, yeah, in that case, yeah. I mean, but then ultimately you get into the question of whether you can bring the DUP on board or whether you have to persuade Gareth Snell and Lisa Nandy and Gloria DiPiero on her way out to vote for a Boris deal, and then we're back to that game.
I mean, interestingly, with Dominic, Paul Goodman, the editor of Conservative Home, you know, has sort of done an analysis of Dominic's thinking, which I think will be very influential.
Dominic Cummings' thinking, yeah.
Dominic Cummings will be very influential on Boris's thinking. And Dominic, you know, there's always this criticism of politics by focus group, particularly in the kind of Cameron Osborne period. But Dominic Cummings apparently said, well, you know, I do better focus groups. They weren't done properly. And he says the kind of three things you need to build that kind of support for the Conservative Party, particularly amongst those on modest incomes. The first is, and I think you'll see this through the Boris government, the kind of themes. The first is around immigration, a kind of points-based immigration system, although a lot of people don't quite understand the detail of what that means.
It's compulsory to say an Australian-style points system.
Yes, so that's the first
apparently
thing.
That polls really well.
The second is more funding for the NHS, which is, of course, a big vote leave promise. I think that's going to come through a lot more. And the third is tax cuts for the lowest paid. So I think they're going to be your three themes that the Boris government, beyond the kind of Brexit situation, will push.
And Ellie, that's quite a difficult cocktail of things, isn't it, for Labour to confront in a way? If you're doing tax cuts for low earners, you're doing more money for public services, it's hard. It becomes harder to caricature that as a sort of hard right austerity. The argument of austerity has been really, really strong one for Labour, hasn't it? That's harder to confront, isn't it?
I think, first of all, I think it's important to acknowledge that the unfortunate truth, which is that Dominic Cummings is very talented. If I was a politician, I would hire him. He's very talented at what he does. And I think the other thing is that I think Boris has had a very good start and he's done exactly what he should do if he wants to achieve what he wants to achieve, which is to have a massive reshuffle and have a cabinet full of allies. I think that was a good move for him. So that's worrying for Labour. In terms of these three things that Ryan was talking about, no, I don't actually worry about that because the Conservative Party will never be able to outflank the Labour Party on public services and austerity. They just won't be able to do that. They will be able to go a certain, they'll offer this, they'll offer that, and maybe people will like it. They will never be able to go as far as Labour. And I think one thing that we need to understand about the Labour Party that isn't talked about that much, I think, because people don't want to acknowledge it, is they have comprehensively won the argument on the economy. They have absolutely won the argument completely on the economy. Every single thing that you could think of, when it comes to the economy, people are where Labour is. So they have won. And I think, you know, they will have trouble getting their message through because they have an extremely hostile media and so on, you know, a fractious parliamentary party. The Remain campaign, you know, Brexit is this, I think last time we were on here, Raf described it as a meltdown in the React core of politics. I would agree with that. So they'll have trouble getting that message forward, but equally, they have a massive movement of 500,000 people that they are actively investing in and training up. So when it comes to the economy, I don't worry about Labour. I think they'll be fine.
Well, yeah, I'd agree that Labour have won the economy in terms of getting the message across. And there is also lots of hostility. And it's traditionally, the Labour have always had this problem of the ferocious sort of institutional headwind.
But it has never been as bad as it is now.
But also, I think ultimately there is, you have to have the conversation about leadership. I mean, it's just, there comes a point where, you know, I'm sure there are lots of people on the left and the Labour side who won't take this from me because I've been a critic of Jeremy Corbyn all along, but I'm sure there must also be people who have supported Jeremy Corbyn for a long time who will now be forced to wait as the things evolve over the next few weeks and months to think, really, might we actually be doing better if we had a different leader? I understand why, because of the huge emotional and institutional investment in the idea of Jeremy Corbyn being this transformational leader who created and will save the project and deliver all sorts of things for the left. It's hard to surrender that, but just a rational analysis of how Labour are performing, you've got to consider whether or not that guy needs to go.
Ellie May?
I think people often, when they talk about Jeremy Corbyn and the movement around him, they often talk about, you know, I interviewed a senior Blairite recently who describes it as an emotional spasm. They often talk about it in terms of emotion. But I support Jeremy Corbyn's leadership and I continue to support that. And the reason for that is not emotional, it's pragmatic. It's because without the Jeremy Corbyn as leader and the people that surround him, we would never have the kind of policies that are coming out of Labour. Things like the Green Industrial Revolution, they're the only party in Britain that has a comprehensive and workable solution to climate change that also delivers equality and justice for workers. We would never have things like employee ownership. We would never have insourcing. We would never have the measures that they're taking on the financial sector to address things like, again, climate change and also to prevent another recession. You know, lots and lots of things that have been produced as a result of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership would not be there if he was not there.
And if you could have a different leader with a different style, but without sweeping away all those advances in policy?
That person doesn't exist. The movement put Jeremy Corbyn there. You know, that's what the movement wants. And, you know, that's the situation. You know, we forget that actually in the 1980s and the 1990s, the left was completely decimated. And that's why you don't have any interesting left-wing politicians that are under 40 and over 60, is because there's been a 20-year gap. So the idea that there's this kind of preternaturally fabulous left-wing candidate just waiting in the wings and for some reason the Labour Party isn't going for that person is, you know, that's just not true. And I think as well, we also underestimate how well Jeremy Corbyn has done in lots of different areas. Like, you know, I think I really was a fan of Ed Miliband. I remain a fan of Ed Miliband. But I think he was far too indecisive, far too swayed from left to right by the kind of whims of his party, by the pressures that's put on, that has been put on Labour. Whereas, you know, I don't think that anybody could have achieved the result that Labour got in spite of all predictions in 2017 without a leader like Jeremy Corbyn, who knows what he stands for and knows what he wants and went into that campaign feeling energised, feeling enthusiastic. And so for me, supporting Jeremy Corbyn is a pragmatic decision. I don't have any particular attachment to him as a person or a figurehead. It's pragmatism.
Ryan?
I sympathise with what both Ellie Mae and Raphael have said about the left winning the economic arguments. And I think to some degree, Theresa May has conceded to that. Mm.
The deficit was barely mentioned in the Tory leadership campaign, wasn't it?
Yes, and you know, her sort of rhetorically, she was talking about going beyond austerity. Of course, her policies didn't match that. But she was, you know, she wasn't sort of talking up some of the successes over the last decade economically. It was a problem. Austerity was a problem. And, you know, people on very low incomes have struggled quite substantially. And I think the axe went too far and was too disproportionate in cutting working age benefits. But, you know, there have been positives as well. For example, employment is at record highs, for example. But I do think generally the left, the way that they can win the argument, I think, is through the economic arguments around public services and revitalising those. Where I think they'll struggle is this idea that the Boris Johnson government is a hard right government. And, you know, psychologists talk about concept creep. The Boris government on fiscal policy is moving leftwards. On immigration policy, it's going to be in a more liberal direction than Theresa May. So to call Boris Johnson hard right, I think a lot of people will switch off to that. And I think we just got to be very careful, and the left have to be careful in discourse of throwing quite extreme language associated with particular people in governments, which I don't think is true. You know, Boris says some things which I think are unacceptable, particularly around what he said about Muslim women looking like letterboxes. I think that's unacceptable. But to say that the whole Boris government is hard right, I think it will put people off. They won't believe it. And then you get to a kind of cry wolf situation where people just think, oh, there's so much noise and complaint and moaning about people that it just switches them off. And I think you've seen that in America. And, you know, that's why Trump has been able to come through. People begin to kind of be suspicious and sceptical and turn off to the sort of how of, you know, this person's an extremist, this person's a racist, this person's awful. I think you just need to be very precise in the way that you describe people.
Well, I would add, crucially, that, I mean, the actual point of the cry wolf story is that there was an actual wolf at the end of the day, and the wolf did come. But no, I think what's right, and what you, it, to the extent that the cleverness of a sort of Boris candidacy is precisely that you can revive not the vote leave operation, but the tacit alliance of Vote Leave and Leave.eu, where Boris gets to do exactly that, the sort of socially liberal, actually, you know, liberal migration, sunlit uplands, this is all about sovereignty. But to get over the line electorally, you need to actually also have, you know, have a leash to the nationalist tiger, which brings you all the slightly more aggressive Farageist stuff. And as long as Boris has got clean hands, he will need to mobilise that part of his voter coalition. And yes, I agree, it is strategically challenging for his critics and for the left or anyone, liberals, to essentially point at the ugliest aspect of Farageism and say that's Boris Johnson, because it isn't, for the reasons that you just say. But that will definitely be part of his strategic coalition.
What do you make of some of these characters, Raph, in the great offices of state? So Priti Patel as Home Secretary, Dominic Raab as Foreign Secretary.
Well, I mean, what we're going to have to confront in the next few years, I think, and this applies actually across the front benches of both parties, and it's a very difficult thing, a different concept to express in politics, is the dynamic force of stupidity in British politics. You know, it's a really hard thing to say, because when you say such and such a person is basically a bit thick, you know, just literally they're cognitively maybe not firing on sufficient sort of octane level to do really difficult jobs. First of all, it sounds like it's a quite rude thing to say.
You sound like a bit of an elitist, Rav.
Exactly. You sound really elitist. You sound like you're insulting the voters who voted for them. So it's really hard. It's arrogant. All these things. Okay, so I can be. I'm perfectly capable of being really stupid as well. I've done plenty of stupid things in my life. I'm also not a Secretary of State, right? But you have to. You know, the reality is that some. I fear that there are some people who have now very, very responsible governments who are just not capable of performing, executing the functions of that government, post well. And there's just sort of stupidity in terms of not really basically grasping difficult abstract concepts quickly. And then there's also a kind of ideological stupidity where you have attached yourself and channeled all of your sort of thinking through such narrow dogmatic channels that you will resist any evidence or counter view because it's so disturbing or because it knocks you off course. To be so wedded to the idea of a no-deal Brexit at this stage, to really make that the absolute driving purpose of your politics, you have to have driven away, and this is true on for some people on the left as well, you have to have driven away so much evidence or empirical capacity from your own mind that you are functionally stupid.
Okay, we'll have to leave that there.
I'm Emma John, and I'm sorry. I lied to you.
It's the spin!
I said we'd be happy if England won the World Cup, but lost the Ashes. It's not true. I want it all. I know it's greedy, but positioning the urn next to the World Cup on Ben Stokes' mantelpiece would make this the ultimate summer for English cricket. So join us on The Spin as we turn ourselves into emotional wrecks all over again. It couldn't be as nerve-wracking as the World Cup final, could it?
It's The Spin!
The Spin is supported by NatWest.
Welcome back. Joe Swinson was announced as the leader of the Liberal Democrats this week. The East Dunbartonshire MP promised to do whatever it takes to stop Brexit and reached out to disaffected Labour and Tory voters by pledging to lead not only the party, but also the bigger, open Liberal movement our country desperately needs. Should the other parties be scared of the new Lib Dem leader? So, Raf, how much difference does a new leader make?
I think it makes a certainly makes a difference to the extent that the Lib Dems now have a leader, and a leader who I think will be more dynamic and energetic than Vince Cable. Just, you know, Vince, you know, he'd just sort of reached the end of his career in politics and wasn't being, I don't think, all that effective anymore. The Lib Dem sort of the performance in the European elections and in the sort of local elections around that time seems to sort of almost come as a surprise to Lib Dems. I mean, they're the theoretical availability of this, you know, just pure Remain space was there, but it almost sort of shook them awake. I'm a little bit sceptical as to how sustainable that is. I haven't seen much in Jo Swinson that tells me that she has a tremendous charismatic capability to really cut through. I think she is very reliant on things that aren't really in her control. One is the extent to which Boris Johnson will chase liberal-minded, moderate conservatives towards Lib Dems. I think that will be a big factor. And you can win seats there. You can win Winchester. You can hold Bath. You can take Richmond in southwest London. And the other is this enormous frustration that Labour hasn't managed to say Brexit only harms the people that the Labour Party is supposed to represent. And therefore, there is an available full-throated opposition to Brexit on that left space that Labour's just vacated for all sorts of weird reasons. And you combine those two things, and there's clearly a huge pool of available voters for the Lib Dems. But my jury's out on whether actually when you get to the heat of a campaign and you've got the two big party machines turning it up to 11, whether the Lib Dems will hold on to their kind of 20s, mid-20s, really rivaling Labour for second place or even a lead. I'm not entirely persuaded that they can hold on to that, but we'll see.
Do you think they're a threat to the Tories under the new leader, Ryan?
Yes, I do think so. And I think Jo Swinson is a very decent and talented person. People who worked in the coalition government say that she was incredibly conscientious, kind, and incredibly kind of creative and clever. So I think she's a real threat. Some of the polling, for example, recently, just as Boris was appointed, looked at, you know, him picking up people from the Brexit Party, but actually the Lib Dems going up in the polls as well, as I suppose some people who are in southern England, maybe more middle class, don't like the no-deal Brexit situation, very worried about that for economic stability, will be attracted to the Lib Dems. I agree with Raphael to a certain extent, because I think, you know, what's propping the Lib Dems up at the moment is that is the whole Brexit impasse and the fact that they unambiguously remain. If and when that ever gets resolved, what's, you know, what does the Lib Dems stand for? Do memories of the kind of, you know, going to bed with the Tories and the kind of tuition fees thing come back, or have we completely gone to a new period? I don't know. But it doesn't strike me, beyond their kind of Remain identity, they've got a clear sell to the public. So if and when Brexit is resolved, or, you know, the next step of it, where the Lib Dems sit, I'm not sure.
So this might be their moment, but it's not, that won't necessarily persist beyond...
Yeah,
beyond Brexit, if there is a beyond Brexit.
But politically, I think it would make sense actually for the Lib Dems to go in a more kind of Orange Book, Nick Clegg direction, and try and win seats from Tories who are kind of worried and sceptical about a kind of, you know, hard Brexit situation, and this idea that, you know, you know the Tories may be going in a kind of hard right direction.
I think a crucial, so to add on to that, I think one of the things that really damaged the Lib Dems in 2015 was the argument, that the sort of Cameron argument, that you just, actually you can't, you don't want Ed Miliband, you know, chaos with Ed Miliband, you know, you don't want that guy being Prime Minister, the sort of SNP tail wagging the English government dog, all that stuff. That was really, well, Lib Dem strategists will say that was really effective, it was killing them on the doorstep, and Cameron was seen, perceived as sufficiently liberal and moderate, that the people who just didn't fancy the idea of Ed Miliband, exactly those sort of actually centre-right voters that Ryan's talking about, went to the Lib Dems. Now, I think that the problem that the Conservative Party now will have trying to use that argument, you know, they think they've got a winning argument, slam dunk argument, which is, come off it, do you really want Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister? That guy's an absolute maniac. You just have to vote for us. And I think now a lot of those moderate, liberal ex-Tories are radicalised about Remain, and will say to the Tories, we don't take lessons in who is a nutter from you, nutter. And so they will stick with the Lib Dems. And that will, so that, but the core, I agree that I think actually the new Lib Dem core is more in a kind of Macron, En Marche, Nick Clegg, centre-right space than actually trying to, you can't outflank the Labour Party on the left, let's face it.
Do you think that's right, Ellie May? They're more of a threat, is she more of a threat to the Tories, do you think, than to Labour?
I think the biggest threat that that, like, the not right wing, I don't want to say left wing, but the not right wing faces at the moment is that Boris has done exactly what he should have done, which is he's completely consolidated the Leave vote. And if he continues in the vein that he is, voters from the Brexit Party will return to the Tories. And meanwhile, the other side will be split amongst the SNP, Lib Dems, Labour, and that could see the Tories getting a significant majority at the next election, and I think that's what Boris is banking on. So I would say that I don't know whether the Lib Dems are a threat to Tories or Labour. I would say that what Boris is doing is a threat to anybody who doesn't support his project.
And what about the prospects of a kind of Remain alliance that gets talked about a bit? So, you know, parties standing down instead of each other. It's happened a bit in Brecon and Radnor, but Labour don't want anything to do with it.
I think, like, it's difficult for Labour to agree to a Remain alliance when, like, such a fundamental part of, like, the Liberal Democrat strategy, and also, you know, like, key figures in the People's Vote campaign, has been to, like, relentlessly attack the Labour leadership. You know, like, one of the first things that Jo Swinson did was attack Jeremy Corbyn and say that she would never go into coalition with the Labour Party. And, you know, I mean, I think Alistair Campbell is a brilliant strategist, but I think he's wasted a lot of airtime on bashing Jeremy Corbyn as part of, and, you know, same with Mandelson. I was on with him in Politics Live, and he talked a lot about Jeremy Corbyn, and so therefore they haven't really laid the groundwork for Labour to participate in a Remain alliance. And I do have a lot of sympathy with Labour on that.
Labour just don't share. I mean, and neither would the Tories, really. I mean, you're a big party. You've had this ancient duopoly. Labour, they won't share. That's not, I don't think it's about, you know, Remainers not having been nice enough to Jeremy Corbyn. It is just, goes, predates Corbyn. It's a massive part of the institutional memory of, and the identity of the Labour Party, that it's, you're one of the big boys, and yeah, you don't share.
Ryan, there was an interesting, I was in Prime Minister's Questions yesterday, and there was a sort of an odd kind of sisterly moment at the end where, you know, Jo Swinson asked Theresa May, it was Theresa May's last outing, you know, what she would say to the men who think they could do her job better than she can. And Theresa May kind of said she was quite glad that, you know, she was bowing out, but she's quite glad there was another woman leader of a political party. Does Boris Johnson have a bit of a woman problem? Can he appeal to female voters?
Well, also, I must say, Harriet Harman was also she was very courteous to Theresa. And I think, you know, it's just good manners, you know, despite the political and policy differences, to be respectful in that way. So it was good to see. Does Boris have a woman problem? Well, interestingly, you know, a lot of senior female Tory MPs seem to back Hunt, i.e. Amber Rudd, Penny Mordaunt. And I think I've seen some polling which suggests that women are more sceptical of Boris. And I don't know the reasons for that, but it does seem to be a bit of an issue. So, yes.
And also, interestingly, just to tackle that, women are more sceptical of no-deal Brexit as well. And polling, I think, is YouGov polling, I wouldn't swear to that. But there's a correlation there. I don't know if those things are causal, but it's interesting that that same pattern exists.
Perhaps we're not so susceptible to the bluster, Ellie May.
Yeah.
The sort of bombast.
I think generally
doesn't go over so well.
Smarter and more sensible. As a gender, I would say, and just generally superior is my analysis.
Sorry, Raph.
Yeah, I'm wondering how that would play in inverted in this podcast. I suspect probably not so much, but I'm not.
I wouldn't go there.
Let's not go there. I think on that controversial note, we should probably end. Thank you all very much. That's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Raphael Baer, Ellie May O'Hagan and Ryan Shorthouse. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.